And I have to run down and present a bill of my own. So when you're done, you can we'll then take Scogan's, go through the Lowen's bill. Hopefully I'll be done by then. If I'm not, then we can take up the my toxic chemical release bill. That's a department bill that they can talk to.
Which order do you want here?
2976.
Yeah, we're here, right? We already did that first time.
Second Saxog, Scogan.
He's going to lay it over?
Yeah, 2651 is done. So it's 2976.
Senator Ingebrigts is going to chair it.
You don't want to do it, do you?
We got those.
Oh, Saxog over there.
Do we have... We have better wait until the chairman calls this to order.
I think we did call it order already.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, do you want me to present Senate File 2976?
Mm-hmm. Please.
Okay. I have a subcommittee report that I'd like to have you move. When everybody got here, didn't we have a quorum?
We're going to continue from today. You don't need a quorum.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to continue from today, so we don't need a quorum.
Oh.
You're senior. Okay.
I'm sorry.
So, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move the subcommittee report.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Subcommittee report.
Yep.
Go ahead.
From the subcommittee on forestry. Is it there?
Forestry.
Yes.
We have it.
Yeah, we have it. It's here.
He's moving the subcommittee report.
Okay. Senate File 2976 is a request from the Department of Natural Resources related to forest road recording. With me today is Bob Tomlinson of the DNR Forestry Division to briefly go over the bill and help answer any questions.
Okay. Good evening. Introduce yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bob Tomlinson with the DNR Division of Forestry. This bill is a fixing up of a bill that we passed in 2005 over here with Senator Saxog's help at that time, that dealt with the alternative recording for state forest roads. The original legislation enabled us to begin a process whereby we're going about throughout 28 counties in the state, one at a time, and working in coordination with the counties, I might add, county government, where they choose to do so with us, in order to formally record prescriptive easements that we feel we have across state forest lands, across different ownerships, and they help us provide access into state forest lands throughout the state. As I mentioned in the previous subcommittee, we've gone through this process already in Hubbard County. We've completed that up there. I believe the Commissioner of Natural Resources has formally adopted the map, and if I'm not mistaken, it's recorded now in Hubbard County. And we are close to being done in Lake, Cook, Crow Wing, Pine counties, and those are going to be done in April. And then we're beginning work on Itasca and Cooch County next. I went through the bill, I guess, and, you know, some detail the last hearing we had. Basically, it kind of goes through and shows what the map requirements are. We wanted to change that because we wanted to have a little bit more flexibility and be adaptive to the county recorder's standards that they might have in each of the counties. We also did some late change to the language relative to what is an adopted map back in the subdivision 2. And then in paragraph C on page 2, we also talked about the process for filing there. And I guess the one, and in subdivision 4, we dealt with the appeals. And the one question that we said we'd get back to you on after that was relative to in paragraph C on the page 3 of the bill, whether or not the property owner must file an appeal with the district court. It was suggested that perhaps that should be to the appeals court. We have done some checking and felt that the district court is the right place for that to occur. Our folks internally in the department have suggested that that's the best for the landowner. And it's also good for us, too, because we can bring additional information to the table, apparently, in a district court than we can with the appeals court. So for that, with that in mind, we'd prefer to leave the language with the district court, not change it to the appeals court. And I had this conversation, by the way, with Senator Frederickson, who had brought this up sometime earlier this afternoon, at which time he said he was pretty good with that.
Mr. Chairman, in line with the first couple of statements that Mr. Tomlinson made, although this isn't part of the previous bill that we talked about, it has a lot to do with access and preserving access to a lot of the state forest land. So we think this is an important bill.
Okay. What is your wishes?
I think that, Mr. Chair, we'd like to, we haven't amended this, so that we'd just like to ask the Senate File 2976 be passed and...
As amended, because it was amended by the...
laid over for possible inclusion in...
That's as amended?
As amended, well, I don't know that we amended it.
Chairman, but the subcommittee, Senator Sacksack, subcommittee report is acts as an amendment. When you move the subcommittee report, you're amending the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry made an interesting point. Should we be adding this on to
who the Senate File 2656?
And I defer to counsel on this, but I'm wondering if this wouldn't be appropriately added on to Senate File 2651 because of its access.
Mr. Knopf.
Questions.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Go ahead and repeat the question, Senator.
Mr. Knopf, we were just wondering, and it was actually this was brought up earlier this afternoon by Chairman Chaudhry, if 2976, because of its concerns for access, might not be appropriately added to Senate File 2651.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxhog, 2651 is your bill that left committee earlier today, and that deals with that's good. That's headed to the state and local government. The question is, do you want to add this to that, or do you want to add it, or do you want to lay it over for inclusion of Senator Chaudhry's omnibus bill?
Well, I think that given again what we're dealing with here, that I would rather have it as part of 2651.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if that's your preference, what you would need to do then is you'd need to set this aside, is move to lay it over, and then bring back up 2651, and then amend this onto it. If that's your intent.
Yeah. Well, if again, 2976 is kind of a meat and potatoes bill. It deals with forest roads and access issues, I really think that. I guess I'd move, and it'd be the same motion either way, that Senate File 2976 be laid over for possible inclusion in either the omnibus bill or in Senate File 2651.
I'm sorry.
Sound correct?
Well, yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think the thing is now is to set it aside, to lay it on the table for inclusion in one or the other or both. And then the question is after you've done that, is what you're going to do at that point? If you're going to bring, because 2651, I'm assuming that the bill is still here and we haven't actually sent the paperwork on that yet, but I don't know.
Well, the deleted, are you talking about the bill this morning?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There has been a committee report done on the deletion and sent to state and local.
Okay.
2651.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sacksack, you may be a little late for attaching it to that one.
So we may have to deal with that in state and state and local.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sacksack, you could add it as an amendment there.
That being said, I would move to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus game and fish bill.
Motion's made. Everybody understand that?
Environment and natural resources.
Okay. The motion has been made. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Both same side. Carried.
Let's do Senator Scogin.
Senator Scogin.
They didn't make any amendments when I was gone, did they?
No amendments. There was no amendments. No.
Just the committee report.
Yeah, just
the subcommittee report.
Senator Scogin.
So make sure you send that along. Yeah.
Pat, I'll take this back and wash it.
Okay. I have a bill trapped. I can take it home and put it in the dishwasher, too.
Let me come here.
Oh, well, I never heard back for sure if they were agreeing.
Senator Scogin on Senate File 2985.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I'm supposed to move the subcommittee report at this time.
Yes.
We talked about it.
That will eventually become 2985.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I move subcommittee report.
So moved. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Carried.
We have quite a comprehensive bill here, and Ms. Lewis is here to help me present what you're going to see. We had our subcommittee, of course, meet, and we have we have three or four amendments what we want to put on. First, get the bill in the shape that we want it in, and then we'll maybe have Ms. Lewis walk us through it. And I apologize because I did not check with, I think DNR has one or two amendments they would like to make. And then I believe Senator Coring had one, and I'm not sure. I see Mr. Knopf left the room, so he may be on his way to get it. Okay. So we may have to just sit tight.
Okay, so, Senator, we're waiting for some amendments then. Is that correct?
The Jay Cook amendment is AO8-1303. So I would move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
I guess we'll wait till it gets passed out. Does it? Everyone, having reviewed the amendment, Senator Scogin moves to amend Senate File 2985, the AO8 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Carried.
We'd maybe have a brief explanation of what that amendment is about, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Go ahead, Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Cortland Nelson, Director of State Parks, and pleased to be presenting this to you tonight. We were approached by Veterans Affairs three or four months ago about working with them to develop a northern Minnesota cemetery site for our state's veterans. Lands and Minerals within DNR initiated an investigation of where might be some possible sites. And we have reached an agreement with them that you see represented in the bill. This is a portion of the southern boundary of Jay Cook State Park. The purpose for this, and I want to cover on behalf of Veterans Affairs, there are an estimated 46,000 veterans within a 75-mile radius of Duluth. 46,000 veterans within a 75-mile radius of Duluth in Minnesota and Wisconsin. There is a federal grant program through the National Cemetery Administration that allows states to apply for development money to build veteran cemeteries so that, there can be an opportunity for 90% of all veterans to be within 75 miles of a cemetery. So that is the opportunity that was created for our state veterans Affairs Commission. They are seeking this language, which then allows them to get a pre-application grant for this federal project through the National Cemetery Administration. So they will send in a letter. They will be given a green light to develop the grant, and that's what this language allows. I'm also told that this gives us a little bit of a competitive edge among other states because the property does not have to be bought. It's owned by the state of Minnesota. We would transfer administrative rights of this property to Veterans Affairs were this to come to pass. Then they would be in the mix based on the quality of their competitive grant for a grant either this October or the next October. There's approximately $35 million available each year for these activities, and each year there are five or six states that get the grant. So if we were to be successful, it's my understanding that maybe not this year, but likely next year, then we would get the development money, which would be somewhere between $6 and $8 million for the development of the Veterans Cemetery at this facility. So that's the process. I would add parenthetically, Mr. Chairman, that tomorrow at 11:45, there will be an announcement with the governor at the Veterans Affairs offices on 20 West 12th Street on the fifth floor conference room. I assume many of you have been there before. And they will be announcing this goal that they have, among a number of other things, for tomorrow, I believe, is Veterans Recognition Day here on the Capitol. Mr. Chairman, can I answer any questions?
Committee, any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson, how does this area fit in? Is this outside the main part of the park, or will this be kind of separate from the park, or will it be in the center of it? Part of my concern is if this takes a if this does happen, will people be able to get to the cemetery without going through the park or without requiring a sticker?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator Frederickson, thank you for asking that question. As you can see by the map, there is the proposed site. It is on the extreme southern boundary of the state park, which is bordered by County Highway 18, and you'll see the railroad line that loops up around this proposal, this proposed area. It would not be necessary for any visitor to the future cemetery site to acquire state park pass because we would be transferring administrative responsibility to them for the property, so there would be free access for that. We do see, however, that this would be a very positive opportunity for our state park visitation. The statistics that are currently being measured at the Little Falls Cemetery, which a number of you are familiar with, there will likely be 50 to 60,000 visitors a year once the internments begin to occur. There will be about 500 internments a year at this site for many, many years. So that provides us with an opportunity to make contact with those individuals about our system and for us to help our park visitors become aware of the opportunity to visit this cemetery site on their visit to the state park.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson.
Senator Frederickson.
Have there been any preliminary archaeological surveys of the site?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, this, as you can see by the photos, this is a former farmstead that has been out of production for some years. There is no perennial streams. There are no view sheds. There are always a chance, as you know, that you will find artifacts. But our cursory examination would be that this area is probably pretty well suited for this kind of an activity. We would certainly be very ahead of the game when it comes to making Veterans Affairs aware of any potential problems. Local tribal members be aware of any issues that may come up in the archaeological work. But that is one of the things that makes this a wonderful site, is that our cursory examination would be a low probability of those kind of problems. There are also a power line right there and a phone line, and as I indicated earlier, there's a nice wide two-lane bituminous that the county has in place that is connected to the site.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Scogin, you have another amendment?
The A3 amendment, committee and Mr. Chair. Public sale of tax forfeited lands bordering public water in Carleton County.
Oh, you got it?
Yeah. This is kind of a housekeeping one. This is one that Senator Lori brought to me after our subcommittee on public lands and waters had met. He didn't have it in time. I asked that I put it in. If you look on line 113 through 115, it is very similar language, indicating that the Carleton County Board of Commissioners has classified the parcel as non-conservation and has determined that the county's land management interest would best be served if the parcel was returned to private ownership. This is typical on these types of tax-forfeited lands, and Senator Lori had just asked that we would amend tonight's subcommittee report to include this parcel in the report, and I would move the A3.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Scogin moves to amend Senate File 2985, the A3 amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Same side.
And then, Mr. Chair, I would just ask counsel if there's another amendment or two. I'm not sure if the DNR had another one they needed.
Asked to adopt the subcommittee report.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I do have SC 6063 amendment, lease rate in Cass County. Thank you, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just explain that this is done in a bill draft format, but it could be adopted as an amendment to the bill, basically the language. We just fit this in where it needs to fit.
We could, Mr. Knopf, we could adopt it at SC
6063 as an amendment to the bill. Even though it's not drawn up as an amendment, you can do that.
Thank you. Members, any questions about the amendment?
I want the committee, Mr. Chair, just to be clear that this is not a DNR amendment. This is brought to me by Senator Coring, and this was a place where we thought we could attach this one. Bob Meyer from the DNR is here. This is done in other ways with other pieces of property as well, but Mr. Meyer has a little better knowledge of this type of an agreement. I would ask him to explain it.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. What I'm handing out to you right now is a copy of the actual contract or lease that this amendment deals with. You can see in the language it says that it shall be capped at 2% and then go from there. If you turn to the back, it's actually page 4 of this. It shows the fee schedule, which July 1st, 2006 was $4,500, and it ends July 1st, 2010 at $10,500. This is at a 9% appraised value, the $10,000 rate. It's a lease for a ski area on Gull Lake. We've negotiated this with them. As I said, our longstanding practice is 9% of the appraised value. We did phase this in. You can see over 5 years we've phased the rate in. By doing this at 2%, it would certainly cap it. It will impact the revenues of, I think, the Forest Management Investment Account. So that's where these revenues are deposited right now. It's an issue of we worked with the landowner, negotiated the rate. He signed the lease. And now I guess we're back here renegotiating with you, it appears. So any other technical questions, Kathy Lewis may be able to answer as well.
Committee, any questions? Senator Frederick.
Chairman, I'm trying to understand this. So, Mr. Meyer, you had a lease for negotiated for 9%. Of the value of the property?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, our practice is we go back and appraise value of 9% is what our lease rates typically are for these types of leases. renegotiated this lease back in July 1st of 2006 is when the new lease came in. That was a new appraisal on the property. The property was worth more. The rent goes up. Just like if you were to lease agricultural land or whatever type of land, recreational land you're looking at, it deals with the percentage of the actual price value. And, I don't know if Kathy Lewis has any more to add on that or not, Mr. Chair.
So,
question, Senator Olson.
Do you have a follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering why this should be an exception to the general rule.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a dog in this fight, but Senator Coring does, and I would like him to explain why he brought this amendment forward.
Welcome, Senator Coring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. And the reason why I brought this to you is up on the west side of Gull Lake, there's some land that's owned by the DNR that is Ski Gull, and I'm almost positive that Ski Gull is a nonprofit. Kids ski for 50 days out of the year on this hill. There's the equipment is there. They do that. The Ski Gull Incorporated does not generate enough money to make it cash flow. So I got a call from one of my constituents who said, can you help us out? This lease is skyrocketing. I have to go to the mill. Thank God for the Mills family, the Donlinger family. They're donating money to make sure that this cash flows. So what I'm just trying to do is make sure that kids can continue to ski on this hill. And if they can't make it cash flow, they'll just not renew the lease next time because it isn't going to work. And so the only ones that lose out is the kids. And, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Mr. Knopf, this is not something that's brand new. We've done this before. At least Mr. Knopf told me in investigating this that we have done this before, if I could.
Oh, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coring, yeah, this is the same, basically a similar language as adopted for Horseshoe Bay in, I think it was 2003, where the Horseshoe Bay leases on Lake Superior are 2% and allowed for an inflation adjustment.
I would stand for any more questions. I would just ask the committee's support on this amendment. I don't think it's unreasonable. In talking to Mr. Mueller, I don't know if he's here now, he seemed to think it would be a wash as far as he was concerned on the revenue.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. I don't know if Senator Coring would be able to answer it, but I'm curious why they signed the lease if there was more than they could afford to cash flow.
Senator Fredrickson, I don't know that. I got a call from somebody that's on the board and asked me to try to do something about this, and so that's why I'm trying to do something about it. Don't have a good answer for that.
I believe that was signed in 2006. Seven.
Six. July 1, 2006.
Land values may have surprised them a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's getting away from them.
What do we do?
Mr. Meyer, would you like to address that?
any more? Any
you know,
more?
And Mr. Chairman, could I say something else?
Mr. Coring.
And I hope nobody takes this the wrong way, but, you know, it seems to me like we get to the point where I'm in a committee and we always say, well, what does the DNR think of this? Or what does the department think of this? I would remind members that we're the policymakers and we're the ones that makes the decision. As soon as the department says, oh, we can't do that, and then right away we decide that we're not going to do something. I think it's up to us. We were elected by the people to make these decisions, and I would hope members feel the same way I do about it.
Thank you, Senator Coring. Point well taken. Any other discussion? Senator Scogin, you wish to move the SC 6063?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scogin moves to amend Senate File 2985. Amendment SC 6063. Everybody understand that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have one more. This is the other DNR amendment. This will be an oral amendment, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to look in Section 5 of Senate File 2985, the oral amendment would be to strike the entire Section 5.
Everybody understand that?
And it's in your subversion. If you're looking up in the upper right-hand corner, 2985 sub. You just turn to Section 5.
Page 3.
He's talking about the subcommittee report.
Page 3.
He's talking about the 1 second, Senator.
Line 310. Section 5. Starting on line 10.
Line 10, page 3. This caused some anxiety in some areas, so we're going to, at this time, ask on an oral amendment to have Section 5 removed.
Everybody understand that? Senator Scogin moves to have Section 5 removed from the 2985 sub. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I believe we have the bill in close to the form we'd like. And with that, I'll turn things over to Ms. Lewis. She has all the particulars.
Welcome, Ms. Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Kathy Lewis with the Department of Natural Resources, Lands and Minerals Division. Since the amendment from the subcommittee is almost as big as the original bill. Let me start with the original bill, walk you through that. The amendments is mostly different land sale parcels. This bill in sections 1, 2, and 3 are technical changes. Section 1 concerns the critical habitat account, and we recognize that the language was not clear in the statutes about contributions being matched with future appropriations. The change does not make the contribution itself contingent on the appropriation, just the match. Sections 2 and 3 are technical changes to the outdoor recreation system components. Several years ago, the legislature approved aquatic management areas as part of the outdoor recreation system, but we didn't go through the other statutes and actually fit them into how they fit within the list of outdoor recreation system units, nor within the system of primary unit versus secondary unit. So we're clearing that up. Sections 4 and 5 of the original bill are additions and deletions to state parks. Section 6 of the original bill adds lands to the Garden Island State Recreation Area. Section 7 adds lands to the Birch Lake State Forest in Stearns County. And then Sections 8 to 16 of the original bill authorize the sale or exchange of specific DNR-administered land. Most of the sales are small or isolated or border water, and the two exchange provisions are because of other provisions in state law that would otherwise prohibit the exchange. The bill also addresses the resolution of several unintentional trespass situations. When you turn to 2985 sub, what you're seeing is incorporated there 13 bills that went through subcommittee and are being incorporated into this bill. So what you see on page 1 is Section 4. This is a bill that actually appeared in Senate File 2651 that you saw earlier today. It's the same land exchange language. We just deleted on page 3 the Section 5. Section 6 comes from Senator Saxhawk. It's for Itasca County. Section that starts on page 4, line 23, is a technical amendment. We found that we had gotten a more detailed description of a road for Lake Chetek State Park, and so we inserted that in the bill. Page 7 of the sub which is now Section 11. What you're starting to is a wind energy project. This is brought as a separate bill to authorize St. Louis County and the DNR to enter into leases for wind energy. Then the rest of the bill in the is the different various land bills that had reviews in subcommittee, and they were brought by separate bills and then combined into this bill. And the DNR had reviewed all of those bills and found that there was no objection to those provisions. That is a synopsis of what this bill is now. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So Ms. Lewis, I have a question on Section 11 there, 30-year lease. Is that a common time for a lease for this type of a project?
Mr. Chair, members, the DNR has authority under Chapter 9250 to enter into 10-year leases, and we can also do up to 40 years, but if it's more than 10 years, we have to get the approval of the State Executive Council, which is our five constitutional officers. We have not gone into the wind energy business very much, and we recognize that there's issues there for leasing the state land, and we're going to be doing further study. And we may come back next session with some ideas for further legislative changes. The provision on in A comes from a proposal from a Mountain Iron Economic Development Authority, and the representative is over there if you'd like to have more details. And he's been working with St. Louis County on entering into issues with them for entry at least. And this would be new pretty much for the county also.
Thank you. Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ma'am, would you be able to tell me where in Dakota County this land is on page 8, section 18? I mean, this is a long description, and the legal descriptions don't mean anything to me. Is this one that we talked about in relation to the bridge, the Wakota Bridge area generally?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Lewis.
This is brought by Dakota County because it's tax forfeited land currently, and they're going to convey it to the county as opposed to being in state ownership. And it's along the Mississippi River, and I don't have the details because that was not our bill originally, but we could provide a map if you'd like us to do so.
That's what I thought.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Lewis, the council reminded me. I was here for it, and I thought it was Senator Benson's area, and it was his bill. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
I haven't looked at great detail, but how does it happen that there are, I think, about 15 parcels of land on public water in Otter Tail County that are being sold?
Several in a row.
But what's that all about?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Lewis?
These are all tax forfeited lands that the county brought forward for selling. And so the county was obviously looking in particular. A lot of these are very small little parcels if you look at the actual legal description. So it was a county initiative to identify these parcels to sell. And the DNR has reviewed all of them.
So Mr. Chair, they're not necessarily even buildable lots. You have to put some together? Are they in any of them attached to one another, or are they all over the place?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, the party always has to comply with local zoning ordinances when they build. Some of these are most likely buildable. A lot of them are very similar in location. When you look at the legal description, some of them are quite close, and some of them are farther apart. So it's a mixture going on in the situation. There is authority under 282 that when you have a lot that is not buildable, the county can do a sale that is just to adjoining owners, so they can do a competitive sale just to the adjoining owners, so they could have a buildable lot. So that's something the county has flexibility to do under existing law.
Any further questions of the committee? Senator Scogin.
If there are no further questions, Mr. Knopf, I believe is this get laid over for possible inclusion? I would ask.
One second. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I think there's some fiscal impact on
At least on Senator Coring's section of the bill. I don't know about the rest of the bill, and I apologize, I missed some of it.
Do we have any fiscal report at all?
No. Senator Anderson, this came up just this morning, and so there is no fiscal note with it. There, I would say.
We've done one.
Oh, you have done. Okay. I refer to Ms. Lewis.
Okay. Do you have that with you, Mr. Chair? Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Mueller? Mr. Mueller has some. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members, generally on these lands bills, there sometimes are some small revenue generated from some of the sales, and we've typically allowed the bills to go separately because we don't really book the revenue as far as we can then go ahead and spend it. Because this just authorizes the land to be sold, and we don't always get the revenue that is sometimes estimated. And as far as the Coring Amendment, I was just looking at the lease agreement with Bob Meyer from the DNR, and we're trying to figure out if that would be lost revenue to the general fund or to some of the other funds. So we'd probably have to get a whole new fiscal note on the bill to see how it all washes with some of the revenue increases that may occur from some of the other lands. So that's why I was telling Senator Coring that it may be, as a whole bill, a wash as far as whether there's a net revenue increase or decrease and whether it's all to the general fund or to other funds. But, like I said, typically land bills have gone on their own, and we haven't always booked the revenue increases or decreases because they're usually pretty small, less than $10,000 or so. But I don't know with Senator Coring's amendment if that's going to greatly change that.
Well, less than $10,000.
Yeah. On its own, but go through finance.
Does that answer your question?
Well, sort of, sure. Mr. Chair. I guess if there will be a fiscal note, I mean, are we going to, will there be a new fiscal note then?
Mr. Chair? There's a fiscal note that was prepared from the DNR portion, and we were raising $27,000, very modest. We can do a revised fiscal note that reflects the new amendments. The one with the lease revenue is very easy to calculate. It's currently at 9% of value. You're dropping to 2% of value, so you take 7% of the rentals and calculate it out, so you have, you know, several thousand dollars calculated out there for that impact. Then the tax forfeited ones will generate some revenue. Those are difficult to calculate for us because we don't have that information from the counties and how much that value is. But generally, we don't have any million-dollar parcels here. These are basically pretty small parcels that the counties and the DNR are looking to sell.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, I mean, if there is a fiscal note, we should look at it in the Finance Committee. It's not probably not a big deal, but I think we need to at least take a look and make sure that's kind of our job.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Knopf, any suggestions as to what we...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wish Senator Shockey was here, but I can tell you, I had a brief conversation with him today, and he is talking about maybe sending his entire Environmental Natural Resources policy bill to the Finance Committee, so not to have to split up all the game and fish pieces in that, because there are a number of game and fish pieces that were talked about. That bill is headed on its in state and local government next, then to finance, and he wants to include those in here too. So I did talk to him about possibly sending his whole bill to the Finance Committee this year. And he seemed to indicate that he wanted to do that. And that would mean that this all would come to the Finance Committee as one package.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I think that would make the most sense to do it as a package if we're able to do that. But I guess I just need to know one way or the other. So as long as we know it's going to come back in one piece, then we can just plan on reviewing this part along with the rest of it.
I think, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, as I understand it, it would be... I wish he was here, but I understand his wishes is that if he's not planning on going to the Finance Committee, he'll have to pull out everything that's related to finance out of this bill, including some of the game and fish stuff. And it sounded to me like he wanted to keep it all together. So
I just, Mr. Chair, the
and this would be included with that.
I just don't know when it will all be put together. Will it be put together after?
I think Friday.
No, Friday
is going to be.
Okay, so Including the game and fish pieces, or are they already separated out?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, there's the separate game and fish bill is on us. It's actually in the state and local government committee now. Then it'll go to finance committee. I think what the senator would like to do is put all the game and fish provisions that passed out of this committee earlier into his omnibus bill and then send that directly to finance. This is what I understood. Again, we just had a brief conversation, though. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's fine. I'll just plan on having the whole bill come to my division. That'll work.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I think the way they would do that is if he decided not to, he'd just pull out everything that had to do with financing that would be objectionable, and then it would be gone. So you would
one way or the other sounds like it's going to get there. So.
Yeah, okay. That'll work.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, if not, I'll move that Senate file number 2985 as amended be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All in favor?
Aye.
All the same sign? Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair of Committee.
I think that's what he wanted to do. Okay. Senator Sharon? Senator Sharon, you're on Senate file 2757.
Yes. Chair Ingebretson, thank you very much, and to the committee members for hearing on Senate file 2757. You should have some materials in front of you on this bill, along with the bill, and I have with me Peter Larson from Larkin and Hoffman, who is a former Minnesota Pollution Control Agency Commissioner, Todd Potus from the National Natural Resource Group, and Barry Ware from Heartland Corn Products, an ethanol plant in Winthrop, Minnesota, that is seeking this discretionary EIS proposal. So thank you very much for your hearing. This is a bill that provides that an environmental impact statement is discretionary for the expansion of an existing permitted ethanol plant. Expands by no more than 60 million gallons per year. Uses 3 gallons of water or less for every gallon of ethanol produced, and is located outside the 7-county metro area. It might be appropriate at this time, Chairman, to introduce an amendment that will place this bill in the order that the author intends.
Okay. I think it's being passed out.
See that. Mm-hmm.
It's the A1 amendment.
Yeah, that's being passed out, Senator.
So as I said, this bill provides a discretionary a process at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency rather than a required EIS study when a plant expands by no more than 60 million gallons per year. With this change...
Excuse me, Senator, should we move your amendment?
Yes.
Senator Sharon moves to amend Senate file 2757, A1 amendment. Any questions on that? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Thank you.
So with this change, an environmental worksheet will be required for an ethanol plant expansion outside the 7-county metro area for up to 60 million gallons. And if the EAW demonstrates a potential for significant environmental impacts from the expansion, the EIS will be required for this project. As an example of a plant that would be impacted by this, we're here to talk about Heartland Corn Products in Winthrop, Minnesota, which is a cooperative owned by 900 farm families. It is seeking an expansion of its production by 60 million gallons. Expansion alone in this part of our state is very important because it is an investment of these owners of $125 million. This bill changes language that requires the environmental impact statement to allow the department the discretion as to whether or not this is necessary. The purpose of the environmental assessment worksheet and the permitting process is to assure that environmental effects are resolved, and to demonstrate no significant environmental impact would occur as a result of their issuing that permit. The goal of this legislation is to encourage highly efficient plants, such as the Heartland plant, to continue to reinvest in cutting-edge technology by creating an exception to the statutes of a mandatory environmental impact statement when those conditions have been met. Among the materials that you have in front of you is a...
Senator Sharon, would you take a question from Senator Parisel?
Yes,
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, if I take the if you take the amendment as it's printed and insert it at that point, it reads: "Two has a permit uses 3 gallons of water or less to produce, et cetera, et cetera." Does that mean "and uses," or should it be? Because it tells you to insert it after the word "permit" in the bill.
Mr. Chairman?
There's
a comma.
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Parisel, you can see where it inserts a comma after ethanol, too, because it already has the "and." It's a string of three kind of clauses there.
All right.
So it is "and." It has a permit, uses 3 gallons of water or less to produce 1 gallon of ethanol, and expands production by no more than 60,000 gallons.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you very much. You have received materials. We also have other materials should they become appropriate during our discussion this evening. But the material that you have received provides what the goal of this legislation is about. And I'd like to draw your attention to the background information that on that first sheet about the Heartland Project in Winthrop, Minnesota. And in particular, I'd like you to take note on page 2 of the limited impacts from the Heartland Industries expansion. And finally, on page 3, there's a number of issues that I'll just run through as a result of the efforts made by the Winthrop ethanol plant as to why the EAW process and the permitting process will assure those of us who are concerned about environmental impact that those concerns will be resolved in that process without necessitating an environmental impact statement. As a result of the efforts that this plant has made, we cannot find any significant environmental impact. The permitting process requires simply in the process of permitting that all environmental issues are identified and resolved. This legislation still allows the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency the discretion to require an EIS. The permitting process, the process through which this plant will have to go through, even without an EIS, is very thorough and detailed, usually taking approximately a year to complete and costing up to $1 million. The applicant cannot begin construction until the MPCA and the EPA issue the appropriate permits. There will be no additional water appropriated until the DNR issues a permit. And following issuance, the DNR and the MPCA have strict and ongoing monitoring requirements. So with that, I'd like to offer you an opportunity to hear from Peter Larson, who is from Larkin and Hoffman, and who, for your interest, you may like to know that he's a former Minnesota Pollution Control Agency commissioner.
Hey, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Larson. I'm with the law firm of Larkin, Hoffman, Daly, and Lindgren. I'm here representing Heartland Corn Products. I just have a brief statement. I would be happy to answer any questions you have on environmental review issues that questions that might arise from this. The environmental review process, as you may know, is a relatively straightforward process on paper. Is this on? There's an EAW, an environmental assessment worksheet, prepared in most cases to determine whether an EIS is required. That's the type of process that ethanol plants have gone through in Minnesota. There's been lots of discussion about that. An EIS might be required after an EAW is prepared. There are a few mandatory categories in Minnesota rules and statutes, and you're looking at one of them here. They're often created to impose an EIS in some special type of facility. There's been some determination that that type of facility warrants an EIS. I think it's pretty clear to me, and I think as you think about it, it might be pretty clear to you that we've got kind of an anomaly here. in that we've got facilities that have gone through environmental review, have permits, have been reporting regularly to agencies on their the conditions of their permit and their compliance with their permits. I can tell you that the agency has become very sophisticated in regulating ethanol plants over the last 10 years as they've learned more about both the production of ethanol and the emissions from ethanol plants. The anomaly here would be that you could have an ethanol plant that's gone through environmental review, been operating for some time, been reporting on a periodic basis to the PCA and others on their environmental emissions, yet you'd for some reason require them to prepare an EIS just because they became a certain size. We can talk a little bit more, if you like, about what an EIS might produce rather than an EAW, but in most circumstances, you'd want an EIS because there's some new issue, some uncertainty, something you don't have good enough information on, and that you'd like to do a more thorough study of something. And I can tell you, I can't imagine that that would be the case with an ethanol plant that's already been operating for some time, fully in compliance with the permits they have from the agency. Now, if you thought as this expansion was being analyzed and you did an EAW that there was an issue that required an EIS, this would not prohibit that. That's the type of process that facilities go through, greenfield facilities right now. And that obviously would be appropriate and would be would happen under this permit. So the summary of my comments is this is really an anomaly in Minnesota rules and statutes that you'd have theoretically a facility with a relatively small increase in production that would trigger an EIS that in some cases may or may not even cause someone to think an EAW would have to be required. And again, an EAW probably will be required for most of these, but it's an odd thing to think they'd have to do an EIS simply because of this type of production increase.
Okay. Good, Jared. I would like to introduce with you Perry Meyer now, who is from Heartland Corn Production.
Honorable Chairman and members of the committee, I'd like to just introduce myself a little bit to you. I farm 3 miles north of New Ulm with my wife, Luann. Our family, we've raised 4 daughters. Our youngest one just went off to college. Our oldest daughter is married to our son-in-law, who we asked to join our farming operation 4 years ago. And it's only because of ethanol that we've had the financial ability to do that. I'd like to say that we have benefited, and by we, I mean my generation has benefited as much from ethanol as my parents and grandparents did from electricity being brought out to the farm. It's been just that important to us. As far as my involvement with the ethanol plant, it was in the early 1990s. A group of us got together to see about building some kind of corn processing plant in southern Minnesota. We were able to accomplish that goal. We built a dry mill corn ethanol plant in Winthrop, Minnesota, which is 85 miles southwest of here. We started with 350 members, 25 employees, and we were producing about 10 million gallons a year. We've grown to we're producing 90 million gallons a year. We have 900 members, and I like to stress that unlike the new plants, we are 100% Minnesota farmer family owned. Unlike some of the plants, they have outside investors. Our profit is state in rural Minnesota. It's revitalized our economy out there. It's been very important to our members. We now have 50 employees, and unlike low minimum wage jobs, we've created what I like to say is 50 new careers. If you look at our payroll production costs for last year, they averaged over $49,100 per worker, and that's a pretty good average salary for southern Minnesota. Our production has grown, and we've incorporated new technologies. It's because of the growth that you can incorporate new technologies. We've been able to reduce the amount of water required from 6 gallons to under 3 gallons to produce a gallon of ethanol. We've also increased our efficiency by lowering the amount of electricity and natural gas costs. Thank you. Yep. At a time when our nation's dependence upon oil imported from dangerous regions of the world threaten our security, our economy, and our American troops, we should all be looking for ways to expand renewable products such as ethanol. That's why I'm asking you to support Senate File 2757, which will allow us to build on the success that we've achieved with a disciplined, conservative, and environmentally safe approach. With this change, we'll be able to create 25 new careers in southern Minnesota, allow other farm families to bring their families back into the farming operations, and to do our part to reduce our dependence upon foreign oil. Please support Senate File 2757. It was authored by Senator Kathy Sheeran. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Chaudhry. I would just draw your attention. We did have in your general material some information to show The work that Heartland Corn Products has done in terms of its efficiency for water and for energy as a result of their investments during expansions. Also, the environmental review fact sheet that does some comparisons of what the various processes provide for us in terms of information. And then the main overall sheet, of course, describes the goal. And I just want to reiterate that for the project that this would impact at Heartland, that it will not require an increase in water utilization beyond what they've already been permitted. There's not going to be a need to expand the permit in terms of the amount of water that they will need for this project. It has made enormous efforts to minimize its water utilization, going against what we're hearing is the trend towards increased water utilization for ethanol production. Heartland is also located in an area where we not need to be making other infrastructure improvements, such as roads. Those are already in place and are able to accommodate this plant and the additional traffic that will be occurring. There will be no additional grain storage, and there are already wells in place in Heartland that are monitored by the DNR, regularly monitored. So this observation process of these wells indicates and would indicate any challenges to the aquifer that serves Heartland Corn Products. With that, I just would say that although we're talking about Heartland per se, this legislation really speaks to the criteria or conditions under which the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency would have discretion about whether or not to require an EIS. And assures you that all of the information needed to protect the environment can be achieved through an EAW or a permitting process, and that if that proves not to be the case, that the department can request an EIS. With that, we'd be willing to answer any of your questions.
Where's the discretion part again?
In the language in the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that discretion comes in the rules themselves. If a project doesn't fit within a mandatory category for an EIS, the discretion is with the RGU after an environmental assessment worksheet is completed to decide whether an EIS is required.
Can't this be interpreted as, when it says no mandatory EIS may be required?
Doesn't that
essentially say that that there won't be an EIS regardless?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the term mandatory is a term of art. There are mandatory categories for EAWs and mandatory categories for EISs. If you don't fit into one of those mandatory categories, it just means that the RGU gets to decide whether an EIS is required. It doesn't mean that one couldn't be required.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, on that point, what do the rules require? What are the standards for the – and I assume the RGU would be the Pollution Control Agency would make that decision, or could it be the local government that would ask for an EIS, and what would they have to show to get that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the responsible government unit for ethanol facilities in Minnesota is the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. There are some mandatory categories, as you can even see here, and even if it doesn't quite fit within a mandatory category, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has the most significant permitting authority and therefore becomes the RGU. The standard is in an EAW whether there's the potential for significant environmental effects. And if an RGU determines that to be true, an EIS is required. There are some more subtle differences in there in the rules about that, whether there's some ongoing permitting authority that could be used to mitigate environmental effects. And there's some more detailed analysis that's done to determine whether those effects have been mitigated. But in the end, it's whether unmitigated effects exist that are potentially significant. That's the kind of the magic determination that an RGU makes in order to decide that an EIS is required.
And My understanding is that the language as it stands would automatically require this without any dialogue. This allows it to, that's what the mandatory language is. It's just required. There's no dialogue or discussion or discretion. This changes that.
So then what would trigger an EIS if this bill were to pass?
If as a result, Chair Chaudhry, if as a result of the environmental assessment worksheet and the permitting process, something were to emerge that would suggest that further analysis needed to occur, then the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency could require an EIS.
When you say something, does that mean anything? Or that there are particular things?
Anything that's related to the permitting process for a plant. Air quality, water utilization, wastewater discharge, any of the environmental issues that are subject to permitting processes in an ethanol plant.
How does 60 million new gallons not use any more water?
Senator Chaudhry, the permitting, what we're referring to there is the permit that's allocated to the plant in Winthrop has an adequate permit process for them to not need to expand the permit expectations from the aquifer that they've tapped into and from the city of Gaylord that provides some of the water utilization.
So they will
be using more water, but they have already got a permit that allows them to use more water, so they won't need to go back in and ask for an expansion.
Yeah, cushioning your current permit.
Correct.
How much are you using now, and how much does the permit allow for?
Give me just a moment. I'll see who'd like to answer that question.
Todd?
Please introduce yourself.
Senator Chaudhry and members of the committee, my name is Todd Potus. I'm a principal for Natural Resource Group. We've been involved in assisting facilities such as Heartland Corn Products in their environmental assessment worksheets for expansions and construction of new ethanol plants. The question is, how much of the current permitted allocation is Heartland Corn Products using? Is that correct?
Hiya, how much is it using now, and how much does the permit allow for?
The permit allows for 465 million gallons of water use per year, and they are able to pump up to 700 gallons per minute on a short-term basis. They currently are using about 60% of that number, I believe. 58%. Okay. So they do have quite a bit of capacity available under their existing appropriation. The facility that they just recently constructed is a 60 million gallon expansion. So the Heartland Corn Products applicants, if they were to move for another 60 million gallon expansion, they have all the existing operating data from that 60 million a gallon expansion that they just recently completed. And that facility is fully operational at this point.
So then after the 60 million gallon additional expansion, how much did you say it would use?
The facility is projected to use about 2.8 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol produced. So if we were to add 60 million gallons to the current 99 million gallons, it would be 159 million gallons times 2.8 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol produced, and
or 40.
It's pretty close to. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to do the math quickly. It's pretty close to that 465 million.
It was 6 gallons per
yeah.
But and they've gotten it down to less than 3.
Yeah, that's good.
Per gallon used. It's part of the factor that's making it work.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
if I could address that a little bit.
Go ahead.
As I said earlier, when we first started, we were using over 6 gallons of water to produce a gallon of ethanol. We're down to 2.8, well under 3 gallons to produce a gallon. And we're going to continue on as new technologies come available and you're able to incorporate them with your expansion, that's the time that you incorporate these new technologies is when you do an expansion. You're able to afford to add new technologies to continue on lowering our usage of water.
Did you come up with a number,
Senator Chaudhry? I calculate 445 million gallons of water per year.
So bumping up against the current.
Still leave about 20 million gallons per year of cushion above that appropriation.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't see who had their hand up. Senator Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does anybody at the table know how many EISs have been done on ethanol plants in the state of Minnesota?
Do you want to save that question for the PCA when they come up? They probably have an answer for you.
Okay, I'll wait.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask if an EIS went forward. Well, I think this plant obviously didn't have an EIS when it opened because it's under the threshold, right? So it's never had an EIS, correct?
That's correct.
And I'm wondering, and we can hear from the PCA and the DNR about this, but I think the question of how much water will be used, I don't think that would come up under the PCA's purview anyway. That wouldn't be. Would that be part of an EIS, or would that just be a DNR permitting question?
It'd be a permitting question.
Excuse me.
Excuse me. I'll have someone who has a lot of experience with this answer the question, if you don't want to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, it's correct. It is a permitting issue. What the RGU does is gather comments from anybody who has permitting authority. The EAW has a list of the permits that are required. There's a distribution list that, and obviously in this case, includes the DNR. And so there'll be a section on groundwater use in the EAW. The DNR works very closely with the PCA staff to draft that section, put it out for public comment, and respond to any comments. So the DNR is very closely involved with the agency as they do on EAW on these projects.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what I'm trying to understand is what information we'd get from an EIS that we wouldn't get if we pass your bill. What exactly would we be getting data on that we will not have?
Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I can honestly tell you that I have a hard time answering that question, thinking of anything else that wouldn't be provided in an EAW on an ethanol plant in Minnesota that would be provided in an EIS. I've been through some very significant discussions on EAWs for facilities in Minnesota, including facilities that are over 100 million gallons. We've had we used to have more air issues than we do now because there have been so many facilities that have air permits now that those issues are pretty well understood. There's not a lot of uncertainty. We've had water appropriation issues where there's discussion over how you do a pump test, whether the protocols have been followed, whether they're appropriate, how the interaction between one appropriation and other appropriations works. Those types of things have been thoroughly discussed. There have been variances from water quality standards occasionally that were needed, so there's a lot of analysis about whether that variance granting is still protective of human health and the environment. And this is a long way of saying the facilities really don't want to do an EIS. And there are people who often have significant questions about the project, and they will bring all of them to the agency. And the facilities really go out of their way to make sure that every question is answered in the EAW process in order to finish the work there. Originally, EAWs were intended to be brief descriptions of currently available knowledge to make a decision on whether potentially significant impacts might occur. It's actually evolved into what I have to imagine. I wasn't there in the 70s when MEPA was drafted, but I have to imagine that no one believed that an EAW would be as sophisticated as they are now. I have to believe that an EAW today must be pretty much what they thought an EIS was going to be back when these laws were passed and these rules were adopted. So apologize for the long answer, but about any issue that could be asked is asked in the EAW process.
What about social and economic concerns?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll say I was responding to the environmental question. Social and economic concerns come into account in some matter more economic concerns when people are figuring out responses to environmental issues that come up. Social concerns, I guess I'll say the social concerns are less discussed, if discussed at all, in the EAW.
Alternatives, alternatives analysis and cumulative effects?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, cumulative effects are a standard part of an EAW discussion now. What was the other one you were asking about?
Alternatives analysis.
Alternatives analysis is an interesting one. At the EASs that I've been through, frankly, give very short shrift to an alternatives analysis for this reason. If you own a piece of property and you're proposing a project, the alternatives analysis, the EIS rules, allow you to describe why you don't have an alternative. The alternative to that might be if you're proposing to build a power plant. If you don't build that power plant, that power has to come from somewhere. If you're going to propose a new airport, those planes are going to land somewhere. An alternatives analysis allows you to figure out what would happen if you didn't build what you were proposing. That's a big part of what an alternatives analysis is. In a case like this, at least in my experience, the description in an EIS of the alternative is we wouldn't build this, but we wouldn't build it anywhere else either, so there's not a significant alternative to assess. Not a complete answer, but I can tell you practically for this type of project, especially for an expansion, the alternative simply is not to expand. It doesn't really provide you a good analysis of some other manner of pursuing the project proposer's goals.
Are you concerned at all that this could kind of drive up costs of the EAW and the time that it takes for an EAW, meaning we take out the mandatory EIS, but now the EAW, even though it's become more rigorous of late, will become even more rigorous, more costly, not only to the agency, but more costs could be shifted to the proposer if this bill passes. Is that a concern at all?
I'll take a shot at that one too, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Larson?
In a circumstance of an expansion like this, I don't have that concern at all. This facility is operating. If you have a parameter you want information on, you can probably get direct information about this facility on that parameter. I can't foresee this type of facility having a more expensive EAW process than they would if they went right to an EIS. I can't imagine that circumstance.
Okay. Senator Dibble had his hand up, then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, you mentioned something about people having questions that will be answered. I think in the EIS that's understood, you know, in the scoping phase, people have an opportunity to, you know, participate and have some, you know, help review kind of the scope of what the EIS is going to be. Is there something similar for the EAW? And then at the back end, you know, certainly within EIS, we understand that there's a comment phase, and then the RTU has to respond to the comments. Is there something similar available for the public to weigh in at the back end too? And maybe the agency can answer this too when they come up.
Mr. Larson, to the best of your knowledge?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, yes. A draft EAW is prepared. An RGU actually publishes it. There's a public comment period. The decision makers' staff, the RGU staff, has to prepare responses to those comments. And there's almost always, I guess without exception, really a public decision-making process on whether there needs to be an EIS.
Mr. What about at the front end, though? You said lots of people will have questions, and those will be answered in the EAW. So at the front end, what's the possibility? That would be the scoping phase for an EIS.
Yeah.
What's the comparable for?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, EAW is actually, by rule, are supposed to be prepared early in the process to allow people to bring up those issues early. You're correct in that there's a scoping EAW in an EIS where people are allowed to ask the RGU in the response to the scoping EAW to address issues in the EIS. That's really a manner of reducing the scope of the EIS. That's a way for people to ask the RGU to include things. And normally the process is for the RGU to push back a little bit and narrowly focus the EIS if they can. The EAW itself is a worksheet with questions you have to answer. People pretty reliably understand that those questions cover the waterfront. In my opinion, in my experience.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill and I were both recall being at the opening of your plant when it first opened. I wanted to commend you on your success.
Thank you.
And ability to expand and the accomplishments you've done in being more efficient in terms of use of natural resources and so on. So commend you for that.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Olson.
Senator Frederickson.
I was there, too.
Were you?
Yes, he was.
I've been in the plant many times.
Okay, further questions for the witnesses? Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask, and I see that you've become a lot more efficient in your energy usage, too, and that's a good thing, but I want to also ask how much additional I think you're using natural gas will be used, and how much more emissions with the expansion?
Does Todd want to make that?
Mr. Portis.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. The question is how much additional natural gas would be used, and how much additional emissions would arise from those operations. At this point, the facility does have a lot of good operating data from their 60 million gallon expansion that they just recently completed. So from a natural gas usage standpoint, they have achieved a level of about 30,000 BTUs per gallon of ethanol produced. So from a projection standpoint, the additional amount of natural gas would be roughly one-third additional amount of natural gas compared to what they're currently using. So from an amount of natural gas per gallon of ethanol produced, they will be using less than they are currently using on a per gallon produced basis. And one thing that's nice about an expansion of this nature for a facility like Heartland Corn Products is that they can make a capital expenditure to improve their overall efficiency, overall heat exchange, heat recovery in the process. So that really isn't possible if you're staying pro quo operating facility like it would be when you're adding additional gallons.
And Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Sir, have you considered looking at some kind of renewable fuel to run the plant, like a couple of the other plants in Minnesota are looking at doing?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have looked at other alternatives, not in great detail because of the cost factor and actually the permitting time. It would take a long time to permit for coal or some alternative like that. And right now we've looked at distiller's grain as a fuel source. But right now, with the price of distiller's grain and the byproduct, it just is not cost-effective compared to anything else. So we will continue to monitor that, but at the present time, natural gas still is our fuel of choice.
Maybe they should have a chat with Senator Berglund.
She's a plant you like to move.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I wasn't suggesting you should look at coal, because I was hoping that you were going to reduce your air emissions, so I was hoping you'd be looking at a renewable source.
I was joking that there's a wood burning plant looking for a location. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Senator Fredrickson, did you have a comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a, if you'll allow me just a little bit of leeway, I have a question to ask Mr. Meyer. We're talking about other advances that this plant has done. Sure. And I know one of your concerns has been upgrading the rail line.
Yes.
Heartland, along with other shippers, has been very proactive in trying to rejuvenate a rail line. And you've been successful to a certain point. But are you using that rail line now for bringing in corn or shipping out the ethanol?
Mr. Meyer.
Honorable Chairman and Senator Fredrickson, we are using the rail line significantly more than it ever has been used. On a limited amount, we've brought in some corn, but primarily our ethanol shipments, specifically from the new plant, entirely are going out on rail. And we are a fair amount of distiller's grain, probably all of it from the new plant, and we're actually shifting some of the old plant over to the new plant, so it'll be well over 60-70% of our distiller's grain will start going out on rail as well. The rail is very, very important to us and continually needs to be improved so we can ship more on it, take the traffic off the highways.
But do you still have to change cars because of that gauge issue?
When we ship ethanol, currently what we're doing is shipping units of 25 up to the central point, Mr. Chairman, and then after that we're joining them together so that we're able to ship a unit of four of them, approximately 96 cars. And then we're sending them out to California as our primary goal. We're not able currently to ship a unit train because of the condition of the rail line. A unit is 100 cars. So we're doing partial and then shipping them as far as we can until they can be combined together.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I happen to know Senator Sharon was at a bill this year to try and improve that rail line, but I don't think it made the cut in the bonding bill. She'll be back again.
Well, I've been to this plant twice on that issue, yeah. And I imagine Senator Langseth will keep bringing us there until it's done.
We need your help.
Okay, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I know there's a bill floating around that would increase the environmental review of ethanol plants, and I don't know if that's been introduced in the Senate. Is that something that this committee will also be hearing? Because I just sort of feel like we're looking at two different directions at the moment, and
it's my understanding that it has not been introduced in the Senate, although that was information that's a couple weeks old. Mm-hmm. So it could have been introduced since then, but as far as I know, it has not yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen it over here.
We haven't received anything. If there's no further questions for the witnesses, I think we have some folks who want to testify. Thank you. Why don't we take some citizens first, and then we'll have the department last.
Mr. Chair.
Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jeff Broberg. I'm a licensed professional geologist, and I want to speak today in opposition to the bill. And I want to go through a number of things here that have been discussed, an interesting discussion, and talk about water in particular. Talk about the EAW process, what do you get if you do an EIS, and issues of water sustainability in Minnesota. Just a little background. I'm a licensed professional geologist and own a consulting company in Rochester, Minnesota. I've been preparing environmental documents, environmental review documents, for almost 20 years in my professional capacity, so this is something that I'm well familiar with. I worked for 10 years in the oil business in South Louisiana, and I learned a couple important things in my experience in Louisiana about liquid fuel production. Number one, it's about depletion. Whenever you're creating a fuel, you're depleting some resource. In Minnesota, the depletion we're talking about is water. And I'll go into that in a little more detail. The second thing is that liquid fuel production's a mess. Cancer rates in Louisiana are off the scale in comparison. And we're asking Minnesotans to expand our liquid fuel production without really knowing or understanding the impact of the consequences of large industrial-scale development. Minnesota's been pretty good and has had a good record of ethanol development, starting with experiments at the university. We see that ongoing with biofuels production. And the development of the pilot plants, I call them pilot plants, the original 14 plants, that most of them produced in the range of 10 to 20 million gallons of ethanol a year. And we started to learn some of the limitations, 6-to-1 water use, the air emissions. There was a time when all of the plants were required to do air emission corrections because of the discharges. And we're now looking at things like the emissions of carbon dioxide and the effects of leaks and spills as we transport large volumes of ethanol across our landscape. That's something we don't know a lot about. In fact, there was a proposal at the LCCMR this last year. Understand and investigate what happens with large-scale ethanol loss. The basic chemistry is understood, but we don't know what happens when it intermingles with our pristine waters. The environmental review process is designed to give us a notion of what the significant environmental impacts are. It's a two, perhaps three-step process that I think wasn't very well characterized by the last presenters. An EAW is oftentimes pretty cheesy, and sometimes it just stinks. We see environmental reviews that really don't get very high level of scrutiny. The one that I'm most familiar with in Yoda has been presented as a draft fraught with errors and obfuscations and trying to hide the facts of environmental impacts that we have. We just saw some of this a few minutes ago. The numbers don't add up. I mean, the numbers that we were talking about in terms of water production, my calculations are that at 700 gallons a minute, they don't meet their limits. The production that they need is at 884 gallons per minute at their ratios. So, I mean, people play kind of fast and loose with the numbers, and you really need a level of scrutiny that's difficult to get out of a citizen review. And we have a political arrangement where we know the administration is supporting ethanol at all costs. All of the agencies are engaged in promoting ethanol. Pollution Control Agency will do whatever they can to get these through as EAWs. The Department of Natural Resources will do whatever they can to make sure that those permits go through. I've engaged in Freedom of Information Act requests on these things, and I know those things from the record. We see the agency making predeterminations of negative declarations for EAWs months before the EAWs are even published. It's a foregone conclusion that the applicant's information is going to be accepted and the EAWs are going to pass through, and we have legitimate risks that need to be addressed. Most specifically, it's about the depletion of our water resources. All 17 of Minnesota's ethanol plants use drinking water, until recently when one of the plants depleted the drinking water supply and had to shift that water use to surface water. All 17 use drinking water, and that's the path that the industry is on. I applaud the efforts of Heartland to do the water conservation, but we're not with an EAW and without doing the EIS on these situations, understanding what the issues are with water depletion. I brought some handouts that I don't know if were passed out or not that I wanted to talk about, just three. There's some in the back there, and they can be passed around. There's enough for the members here. specifically about the water. And what I want to talk about is the fact that we don't know enough about this to make informed decisions. In my analysis of water use in ethanol plants in Minnesota, in nine of the plants that I've looked at, the wells are the largest single water wells in the counties they serve. They are the largest water users in the counties. That has not held true in the areas that are irrigating their corn. In those instances, we have more water use from the irrigators than the ethanol plants. But the first thing I wanted to point your attention to is this handout, and it's a slide from a PowerPoint presentation that was presented by the Pollution Control Agency about siting ethanol plants. The thing that is interesting here, they go through what the issues are in this, feedstock supply, transportation, energy source, co-water, co-products, and the last issue is a question mark. The last issue is water. It's not a statement, it's a question. The next map that I have really demonstrates that, and this map represents what proportion of the state we've done enough geologic mapping to understand our water resources. And you can see that we have an incomplete set of geologic atlases. The dark colors are hydrologic and geologic atlases. And there's little or no data that exists in the yellow areas, which constitute about half of our corn belt in Minnesota. We don't have the fundamental geologic information to determine whether 800-gallon-a-day wells, a focal point well, is a sustainable water use. That's gets to the point of what can we learn with an EIS, and why do we need an EIS in a process like this? We have another thing here that was presented by the United States Geological Survey. I'd like you to note the date on this on the lower right-hand corner. This is January 2007. This was the first study completed in the state to understand what the recharge rates are of our aquifers. Getting to the notion of what represents a sustainable water supply. Only a year ago did we have good professional data that really starts to tell us where we can have high volume water withdrawals that might exceed the capacity of our aquifers to recharge themselves. And as varied as our landscape is, you can see in the maps, it's a varied profile that ranges from recharge rates of less than 2 inches a year to over 10 inches a year. And when we put that in perspective of the increasing demand that we have for ethanol production, if it's Minnesota's goal to produce 2 billion gallons of ethanol a year, we should know where this high volume water use is going to occur and whether it's going to deplete our children's and grandchildren's drinking water supply. I think that it would be a crime to convert our drinking water for future generations for a fuel additive. And I think we have to be very careful about the thing as we move forward in the use of our water. We have an EAW and EAS process that helps get at that. Like I said, the EAW is a fairly rudimentary, you answer the 32 questions. You hope nobody asks any other hard questions, and you're done, and you can go to build. What wasn't really discussed is that an EIS process also is a protective factor for not only the community but the investors. It would be wise to identify risks like water depletion. A $125 million investment is not something you want to mess up on. You want to make sure that you're going to have a sustainable water supply for the 50-year lifetime that you expect the plant to operate. And that's one of the things that we would get out of an EIS. I said, well, how could it be that you'd have an EAW that would be okay for this size plant, but that wouldn't be okay if it's this size? And it's because it's about depletion. It's about more resource use. Their permit in this instance was allowed up to 465 million gallons a year. They're not using it now. They intend to max that out. And do we know whether that's sustainable in regards to how rapidly our groundwater and our drinking water supplies replenish themselves? The EIS process allows scoping, which means that you can identify the specific areas that need further investigation. It's not required that you do a global view necessarily in an EIS, and certainly if an EAW had been prepared beforehand, you can scope that down to the very issues that are of concern. So I put to you that larger volumes have larger concerns when we're talking about depletion. Larger volumes have larger concerns when we talk about the risk of accidents and the fate of contaminants that might occur, like happens in every liquid fuel production facility. We would get more information about the impact of greenhouse gases, hundreds of millions of pounds of carbon dioxide in the fermentation process that's not captured and is emitted and is a greenhouse gas. It's been my experience that the representation made that the agencies work very closely together is false. In the issues that we see, raising the prospect of high-volume water withdrawals creating groundwater contamination by drawing in shallower contaminated groundwater into pristine aquifers, we can't get an answer. The Pollution Control Agency says it's not our job. And the DNR says, no, we're water quantity. It's not our job. That's exactly why a rigorous scientific effort to understand the impacts of those resource consequences is needed. I wouldn't probably have an objection today if this was an exemption for this plant. If we said, Heartland, you've done a good job, you're okay, you can go forward. But to apply this exemption across the landscape in the different sensitive areas that we have across the state of Minnesota is asking for trouble. We have only one plant in the karst area in southeastern Minnesota. A 60 million gallon exemption for them to conduct an environmental review could have consequences on our water supply and the sustenance of our trout streams. These are legitimate issues that should be investigated, and it doesn't cost that much money. In a $125 million prospect, 1% to protect the environment and to protect the investment of the operators is prudent spending. It's not that big a deal. And through the scoping of this, we should be able to understand and focus on the real issues of concern and come up with a document that allows us to prevent hazards and not just mitigate for them when they occur. It's quite disconcerting to read EAWs like Janesville, where they said 30 wells, local wells, will be depleted. 30 wells within 20 years will go dry. We're trivializing our drinking water. The EAW EIS process allows us to get a handle on what the impact is going to be. Biofuels are going to be necessary. Conservation of our water is going to take a priority over that. So I would ask today that you consider rejection of this bill and its amendment. The environmental impact statement should stay intact. Thank you.
Mr. Broberg, aren't they saying that depletion is a concern, but it can simply be inferred from the EAW?
We really haven't understood what the impact of that is, and I think it goes to the point that in 9 of those counties, it's the largest well. We don't really know and can't model what the impact of those wells are going to be. And the format that we have in our Minnesota protection is simply to mitigate for those other losses. If you draw down to the in Granite Falls, you draw down the aquifer 70%, you go to another source. That water's gone. We need to do better.
In this example, Heartland has the 465 million gallon permit, and they're not going above that. Doesn't that indicate then that that level of depletion has already been permitted and does not need further review?
Yes, that level of depletion has been permitted and will not get further review unless there's a problem that requires that mitigation.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I think that kind of begs the question about whether the permit review, and maybe that's a goes a little bit beyond the scope of this bill, but not beyond the issue of this plant or other plants, is the permit review really getting at the issue of depletion adequately, of groundwater depletion? And, you know, in the LCCMR, you'll recall we had a discussion about this last summer or fall, whenever it was, when we had a presentation from some DNR hydrologists that were asking for money to continue their mapping of aquifers across southern Minnesota. And, you know, Mount Simon Aquifer was one of the ones that we heard discussion about, that it's not adequately tested. We just don't, we have very few wells. I have some testimony from that said they had, okay, they have 67 well observation wells in the Mount Simon Aquifer, and we should have on the order of 600 for a comprehensive network. And we had a lot of discussion about having a sustainable groundwater use policy in the state, and the impact of that discussion was that we don't have enough information to really know how much usage is sustainable. And that applies not just to ethanol plants, of course. That applies to all kinds of groundwater usage throughout the state, that we really don't have any kind of we don't have enough information in these particular areas, though, to justify decisions. That's what I heard from the DNR this summer from those hydrologists. I mean, I don't got it. So that concerns me.
All right. Are there any more questions for Mr. Broberg?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Broberg.
We commonly hear the issue of ethanol doesn't use as much water as some other thing. The point is, I've heard this, it doesn't use as much as golf courses. It doesn't use as much as Pine Bend Refinery. That is nothing but a rhetorical technique to misdirect our attention about the site and the impact that that water depletion will have in our area. Where I live in the Karst region, those sites are important because our surface water and our groundwater are closely connected. So we can't just say it's okay because Pine Bend uses more water. It has to be a look at how are we increasing the amount of water that we're using. And if our intention is to convert a dry matter into a liquid fuel and produce our 9 million gallons projected in 2050 of liquid fuels in Minnesota, we have to be very careful about the protection of our drinking water supplies. And we should be looking at water use in the tailwaters instead of the headlands. And surface waters, not drinking water. Those are the alternatives that we could come to through completion of an EIS.
Okay, thank you.
Sounds like this guy.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Chairman, members, my name is Bob Thomas. I'm a farmer from southeastern Minnesota, about a dozen miles east of Rochester, Minnesota. Mr. Broberg is here representing myself and an organization called Concerned Citizens of Olmsted County. We have a plant that's due or suggested to be built in our area in the near future. And about a year ago, let me add, I'm not an expert like Mr. Broberg or many of you here. But about a year ago, I got involved in this because I heard about this new plant be built. And I had differences of opinion at that time, good or bad, pro and con. And I would like to take the rest of your evening talk to you about ethanol plants. I won't do that. In fact, Mr. Broberg presents a very good picture, and I wish I could say it as well. But I was amazed at sitting in to the EAW process and to find out just exactly what was happening there, in so much as protecting the people. We have a system in place. And each time individuals like myself get involved with these types of things, we realize how little we're represented. I sat through the last EAW, and I noted that there were three requirements to pass an EAW: air quality, water, and discharge water. Each one of those were answered with words that I know you've heard before. Any good report writer or reader has heard them, indicates, I'm comfortable with. Now, it was previously said that you can ask all the questions you want, and that's true at the AW. But the answer wasn't given what kind of answers you get. And the answers were few and far between. And I don't want to talk all night, as I said, but what's in the air, the plume that comes out of a ethanol refinery? We're told that it's water, but what else? What else is in that plume? I haven't been able to get that answer. Maybe you folks have it. The discharge water that is going to come out in our area will go into a creek.
This only applies to this plant.
And it's indicated that it has salt in this discharge.
I don't want it to be broader. I think they need to narrow it.
But there's nothing else evidently is in this discharge. I wonder what else is. And then we have the water sustainability. Just to back you up a couple of years, when we were told the earth was flat. 1950, they told us we'd never run out of oil. Now we're here, and I have people from the government who have said, my friend, Mr. Thomas, you'll never run out of water. You have all the water you'll ever want in southeastern Minnesota. But let me ask you this. The people that live up here in the metropolitan area, I guess we refer to it as, you're using three times as much water today that you're replenishing yourself with. And you don't know if it is going to replenish itself. And the EAW so far, the way that's answered is, we'll pick a spot we don't know and we'll call it 100%, and we pick a spot we don't know and we'll call it 0%. And we'll use water until 75% is gone, and then we'll stop and see if our water system will replenish it. You, as a business person, would do that with your business? I don't think so. One other thing that really kicks people in the gut really hard is when you put these ethanol plants in the city. You know why we're doing that? It's because of TIF.
Because of what?
Why in the world do we have laws that put our ethanol plants a half a mile from the cities? In our area, we have two wonderful schools, 1,800 people in a beautiful little city that people have come out and built their houses in. And I'm varying a little bit here, and thank you, Chairman. But we have to deal with that, and our ethanol plant is supposed to be a half a mile from our schools, our city. And getting back to the plume, what is that brown stuff that coats your siding if there's nothing else but water in it? Now, I think, Chairman, and I thank you folks for listening to me. I get high-strung on this because about 6 months ago, I decided whether I was against ethanol plants being in cities. And that's the way it is with me from this point on. You folks have to deal with the water problem, the air problem. I wish if anyone here has any leverage, you would think about the TIF problem. If you put these plants 5 miles outside the city, you'd protect our kids and the people who originally were in the city. And there isn't anything in place right now to cause the plants not to be built within the city. It's wrong. It's foolish. Thank you so much.
Questions for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Any other citizens wish to talk? We'll take them. Otherwise, why don't PCA approach? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Myrna Hallbeck, and until recently I was the ethanol manager for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'm still working on a couple projects as they go through. So I'm here mostly to answer your questions, but just a couple things on the technical viability of the bill as proposed. One of my main concerns as the bill is proposed would require the EQB and likely our agency is providing the technical documentation with DNR to look at a set of rules that address those issues that don't meet the conditions as expressed in this. In other words, those facilities who don't meet the 3-gallon limit, and that will be the majority of facilities currently, those facilities that are looking in the future and how they will expand as well. I'm not going to talk about, you heard a lot from both of the previous speakers about specific projects, and my testimony will be mostly about that we write rules and typically write policy that expand more than one facility. So not every facility is located in as good a area as the Heartland facility. We have facilities that are near wetlands and other sensitive areas that putting the additional capacity of the equivalent of another facility. Our average facilities right now are still in the 60 to 70 million gallon range. It was just 4 short years ago when the legislature raised the threshold for the environmental impact statement from 50 million gallons to 125 billion gallons. And that was because technically we felt we understood the permit requirements, the impacts of 50 million gallon plants, and that environmental review indeed could address those. We have not yet had a plant the size of this facility that we understand all the air risk analysis. And an air risk analysis is one thing that happens during the environmental review process. And that a 60 million gallon addition to a plant, even operating in its existing permit conditions, could actually show impacts. And that changes to the facility might be needed to reduce those impacts to do. So I ask you to think about the policy before you as to whether you are setting for one facility or for all facilities to do. The other part of the process for us is that we don't often know local concerns, sometimes until the public have actually seen the draft environmental assessment worksheet. It's not a good test of, from our aspect, of whether we've heard anything yet. The last three projects I've dealt with, the issues have come up either because we had informational meetings requested by the citizens to come out, or that we went out knowing that there were some issues, or during the draft permit, draft environmental review, citizens came and asked us to meet with them, of which we have done all cases with them. So we did not know that to do. Discharge, wastewater discharges, we have non-degradation reviews. The current discharge of a stream or surface water body meeting under one circumstances may not be able to meet an increase to do that. So when we look at the difference between environmental review to an EIS, and typically those EISs have been set at a standard where we don't yet know all the environmental conditions, we have standards where we look at EISs for industrial warehouses in non-incorporated areas, and that is because they could have impacts. And so we're looking at the present time of trying to evaluate what are air risks, what in the EIS would we do on alternatives, whether it be energy, fuel sources, water uses. We've heard about whether we use drinking water or we use another source. Those are the sorts of issues and comparisons along with the social and economic. You've heard about potentially the cultural changes happening on our landscape. When we're combining facilities and we're going to very large facilities, those are the issues that the EIS addresses. It would be my hope that we would learn to scope the issues. EEW processes have become more technical because as project proposers, we have tried to avoid EISs, not because the Pollution Control Agency tries to avoid EISs. The data is merely the data there. If someone pulls back and wants to improve the data, that is what happens. They want to pull the project. We merely evaluate the project as proposed. That is what we would do in this case should you go this way. We will look at the project proposed, and we'll have to make the decision as we get the data and go through the public process on whether we need an EIS. That I just would stand for questions from the facility.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Hallbeck, I'd like to go back to the beginning of your comments. You referenced you may have to do rules if this bill is adopted. Is that correct? Would that be rules for both PCA and EQB?
I can hardly hear.
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, the rules would be the EQB rules, so they are contained in the environmental quality set of rules that are thick, and those rules would need to either stay as they are for the now current mandatory threshold, 125, for all facilities that don't meet the threshold as explained in this legislation, or we would modify to put this in and see what modifications would occur with the rest of the set of rules. But the current set of rules set a mandatory threshold of 125 million gallons.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hallbeck,
Senator Fredrickson,
if this bill does become law, how long would it take the EQB to adopt rules to implement it?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, it's difficult for my agency to do emergency rules in a year. I don't know how fast the EQB could do it. There are just a number of public processes along the way in the technical that it takes typically a year for a very short rule.
Ms. Hallbeck, did you hear Senator Dill's question from earlier regarding how many EISs have been done? Are you able to answer that question at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, yes, I am. There have been no EISs done to date.
Follow-up? Senator Dill?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, that's what I thought. But on the 17 ethanol plants and the several under construction, have they all had EAWs done on them?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, to my knowledge, they have. I was not involved in the very earliest of what we would think of the very small 12 million gallon, but the 5 million gallon threshold for a mandatory EAW has been in the rule for a long time, so I would assume yes.
Okay. Well, just to continue this line of questioning here, now in Minnesota we have, is it about 30,000 registered feedlots, or where are we at?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dale, that is approximately correct, yes.
And as of a year or two ago, there was only two EISs done on any feedlot in the state of Minnesota. Is that still correct?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dale, correct.
That's correct?
That is correct.
So the point I was going to make is that we know a lot about feedlots, and the need for doing EISs is pretty low because we already know a lot about how they work and what happens and what the rules need to be and so forth. So with 30,000 feedlots in the state, we've done two EISs. Now, and I think the same thing is really true for the ethanol plants. We know a lot about them because we've been building them for a decade and a half, and we've got 17 online now, more coming up, and they're extremely expensive. EISs are extremely expensive. And so I am just going to say at this point in time that I'm supporting this bill, and I think we should pass it. And the concern about the environment, I think, is appropriate, but we can deal with that as we go along with the laws that we've got. And like I said before, we already know a lot about it because there's been so many constructed, and the risk of adding to an existing plant that's really in a pretty ideal location with adequate water supply is quite low. So I think we should pass this bill out.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I may. The first was Mr. Robert brought up a whole other issue, and I'm wondering if the PCA, this is outside of the permitting issues, and that's the issue of spilled product. Is that an issue that the PCA has been looking at or has considered?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, let me answer that question in two ways. One is that all ethanol facilities are required to have a spill prevention plan and look at their existing facility and what would they do in the case of it. There are also built into the permitting of the tanks and those sorts of things, double liners that are to hold any product that might be spilled at that area. They also are required to do stormwater prevention plans to address facilities at the site. So that's what happens at the facility. The second area that our emergency responders are doing in response to a train accident where we had thousands of gallons of ethanol spilled is actually looking at what it takes to do that cleanup. What are the issues around it? And they've been working both with locals and on the national level to better understand that. So we are looking at it. We set in precautions during the permitting process for tanks as required by federal law and our own rules. And then on top of it, our emergency responders are looking further at what we need to do.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. And then going back to EIS versus EAW, I was given to understand an earlier testimony from Mr. Larson that should any issue crop up that would seem to need to trigger an EIS under this bill as presented, that would be provided for. Is that how you understand this bill?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that's credit if the discretion is the RGUs, which for ethanol plants is the Pollution Control Agency. If there's not a mandatory threshold, then through the environmental assessment worksheet, as we have to do for facilities less than 125 million gallons, we would have to make the determination on whether an EIS is appropriate because sufficient information is not available for us to make a determination, or we see that there's a potential for significant impact, or there are not regulatory controls in place, or the project, if it had an impact, couldn't reverse those impacts. So we do have to make that full analysis now, and we would have to do that for projects that meet this criteria.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'm also going to go back to your discussion about what you would gain from an EIS, I think, in terms of more information. And I think what I heard you say is that you will be able to look at alternatives to water use and air emissions that are in the proposed project, and you won't be able to see what those alternatives are or request those under the EAW. Did I understand that right or wrong?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, you're correct. An environmental review from the worksheet perspective is based on the project as proposed. And so what we're doing with that environmental assessment worksheet is analyzing the data around the project proposed to us. Once you move to an environmental impact statement, then you look at alternatives, including one of those being the no-build alternative.
And, Mr. Chair,
Anderson,
you said something about when you talked about air emissions, being able to study that potentially, because this addition is as big as a whole plant, that potentially there could be problems. And I just want to figure out what you mean by that. I think, are you suggesting, this is hypothetical, I'm assuming, that it could exceed some emissions limits or something like that? Is that, what kind of issues would you determine that you won't find in an EAW about air emissions?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, while the environmental review does look air risks, so that's risks from the emissions to human health and the other issues around it, it won't evaluate what if you change the facility would decrease those risks, which might modify those risks. When we have done preliminary assessments, looking at what between a 100 million gallon plant and the current 125 million gallon EIS threshold exists, one of the areas that we believe would change is the type of permit typically needed by these facilities and whether hazardous air pollutants actually go over a threshold that we call minor versus major. So there are those sorts of issues that we would be looking at. Again, you can look at them through environmental assessment. The EIS, if found necessary, has you look at what are the options to those.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I want to go back to the rulemaking question then. If you had to do rulemaking, if this bill were to pass as written, how much would that cost? And would this plant have to wait for that to be done before it could operate its expansion?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, if this bill passed, this plant meeting these conditions would be allowed to move forward as just an EAW.
Okay.
What we would do under, and I haven't looked at the bill as currently proposed with the 3 million gallons. The previous that I looked at, I thought it would take about 0.2 FTE from the PCA side. I haven't talked with my counterpart at EQB to understand what it would take from those. With the addition of the 3 million gallon provision, or 3 gallon provision there, so the efficiency ratio, that brings up, we're not just taking facilities and moving them if they're less than 125 permitted and they're expanding by 60 million. Now we have a standard by which they have to do. So I could meet 125 and I might meet 60, but I don't yet meet the 3 gallons as an efficiency thing. Therefore, the rules would have to look at that efficiency and what would we do in the cases where that was not met.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, are we going to hear from the DNR?
Is DNR here? Not seeing him.
I might be able to answer some of the questions.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hallbeck, I guess the last question would be related to the issue of sustainable water usage, which we've had some discussion about, and whether or not it relates to this particular permit. Is there an overall standard in place that
is protecting aquifers, drinking water aquifers, from being overused.
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, there are a couple things I'd like to inform. If anyone has followed the discussions at my Citizens Board in recent months, they have been concerned with this same issue. They asked the EQB to consider what could state agencies as staff do to evaluate that. That process is currently going on, so we have a better understanding of it. Typically, what DNR does relative to the sustainability of their aquifer and what they look at is set a threshold for those wells so that if 50% of the available head, not 50% of the amount of water that's there. So if you put the pipe in and you have 100 feet of water in that well, 50% of that disappears, they will ask the project, whoever it is, to start looking for an additional source of water so that doesn't go. If it gets down to 25% remaining in that pipe, so they use 75, as you've heard, will require it to be shut off so that it can recover. During their modeling, what DNR does is try to anticipate 20 years worth in what will happen. And so they try to investigate. As you said, they also try to set up observation wells so they can have a network to look at what's happening in that. So they are trying to understand sustainability. They are trying to set up their permits in order that you do not deplete the aquifer that you're protecting of the aquifer. And as state agencies, we're working with the EQB staff to look at what do we need to know long-term about Minnesota's water.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Hallbeck, just to go out on a limb and ask you to express your opinion, do you think that the existing, I mean, given the existing information that we have and testing that we have, can we be assured that existing permits across the board, you know, I'm not focusing on this plant, but for all the plants that are on aquifers, can we be guaranteed that they're sustainable, that they're at a sustainable level? Or is that really in question now, given that we're looking at it more closely and trying to get more information?
Ms. Hallbeck.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I will give you the answer I give everyone. I never give guarantees. I believe that in working with DNR, we have closely evaluated those and we're comfortable with the ones that we permitted at the level we permitted. My board asked questions on a project that came before them last summer. That project decreased its size in order to do it, and DNR was comfortable then with that. So I do think we have to maintain diligence on looking at the water usage and what's happening. When I've been with citizens and with the industry, I've recommended that we use conservation and we look at other alternatives for our source water, including wastewater and other areas where we could do that. I still believe that is part of any comprehensive program that we do.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess this is a broader discussion about how to ensure sustainability as we look at how many more proposed plants, 15 or whatever you said, Senator Dill, a lot more proposed plants. But that's maybe a question for another day.
There will be a meeting on this bill at noon tomorrow in my office, and all interested parties are invited to attend. Until then, I'm not comfortable moving this bill forward, Senator Sharon. Senate file 2757 is laid over for further consideration, and anyone who wants to come to my office at noon to talk about this more is welcome to do so, and we'll try and figure something out with this. Meeting's adjourned.
So much things have to be.